A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about that book, The Five Regrets of the Dying, by Bronnie Ware, the hospice nurse who spent years with people in their final weeks. The top regret, the one that keeps surfacing for him, is, I wish I'd let myself be happier. And the question is, why don't we let ourselves be happier? We predicate our happiness on achieving things, on meeting standards that aren't even ours, and then we wonder why the goalposts keep moving. So the prompt is really asking, how do you break that loop? What are the strategies for being happy, regardless of what you've achieved, or what setbacks you're dealing with?
There's a line from the book that I think gets at the core of it before we even get to strategies. Ware wrote that people don't realize until the end that happiness is a choice. And that's a phrase that can sound glib. Like, oh great, thanks, I'll just choose to be happy while my life is falling apart. But she wasn't saying it's easy. She was saying that when people looked back, they saw they'd been the ones holding themselves back. They stayed in familiar patterns and familiar misery because changing felt riskier than staying unhappy.
Which is a genuinely terrifying sentence if you sit with it. The idea that people would rather be predictably unhappy than risk an unfamiliar kind of okay.
That's not poetic license. There's a body of research on this. Psychologists call it status quo bias, and it's especially strong with emotional states. A known discomfort beats an unknown comfort every time. People will stay in jobs they hate, relationships that drain them, cities that don't fit them, not because they're trapped, but because the alternative is uncharted. And uncharted feels like danger to a brain that evolved to treat novelty as a potential threat.
The first thing we're up against isn't even the external circumstances. It's that the brain has a built-in preference for the devil it knows.
And that's why half the strategies for breaking this loop aren't about adding happiness. They're about lowering the perceived risk of change. But let me back up and anchor this in something concrete. Sonia Lubomirsky, who's been researching happiness for decades at UC Riverside, has this framework that I think is the most useful starting point. She and her colleagues found that about 50% of our baseline happiness is genetically determined. It's your set point. 10% is life circumstances, your income, your health, where you live, whether you're married, and the remaining 40% is intentional activity, the things you choose to do and think.
Wait, 10% for circumstances? That seems absurdly low. If someone loses their house in a fire, that's only 10%?
The research bears it out, and it's counterintuitive enough that it's worth explaining. The 10% figure comes from studies tracking people through major life events, winning the lottery, becoming paraplegic, getting married, getting divorced. And what they found is that people adapt back toward their baseline faster than anyone expects. Lottery winners are not significantly happier than controls after about a year. Paraplegics are not significantly less happy. The emotional impact of even enormous life events gets absorbed by what psychologists call the hedonic treadmill.
That's the thing where you get the thing you wanted, and then immediately want the next thing.
Right, but the mechanism is subtler than just greed or ambition. It's that your brain recalibrates what counts as normal. You get a raise, and for about 3 months you feel great, and then the new salary is just what you make. You move into a nicer apartment, and for a few weeks you notice the view, and then it's just where you live. The baseline shifts. And this is actually adaptive. If every positive change permanently raised your happiness, you'd eventually run out of ceiling. The treadmill keeps you motivated. The problem is when you don't realize the treadmill exists, and you keep chasing the next thing, thinking this one will finally do it.
You're on a treadmill you don't know you're on, running toward a finish line that keeps moving, and meanwhile, 40% of your actual happiness is sitting there untapped because you're too busy chasing the 10%.
That's the tragedy in a sentence, and it maps perfectly onto what Ware observed. The dying people she sat with weren't saying they wished they'd had more money or better jobs. They were saying they wished they'd given themselves permission. Permission to enjoy what was already there. Permission to not wait until they'd earned it.
There's a phrase that keeps coming up in this research. Conditional happiness. The idea that you'll be happy when you get the promotion, when you lose the weight, when the kids are out of diapers, when the house is paid off. Happiness is always downstream of the next milestone. And the milestone arrives, and the condition just moves.
Daniel Gilbert at Harvard has written about this extensively. He calls it miswanting, the systematic error we make in predicting what will make us happy. We think a bigger house will do it because we can imagine the space, but we can't imagine how quickly the space becomes background. We think a new car will do it because we can imagine the smell, but we can't imagine the smell fading in 2 weeks. Our effective forecasting is terrible.
Effective forecasting? Predicting how you'll feel in a future scenario.
Yes, and we're consistently wrong about both the intensity and the duration. We overestimate how happy positive events will make us, and we overestimate how devastated negative events will make us. The breakup you thought would destroy you. 6 months later, you're fine. The promotion you thought would complete you. 3 months later, you're stressed about the next thing.
If we're this bad at predicting what makes us happy, and we're building our entire lives around these predictions, that's a recipe for exactly the regret we're documented.
That brings us to the strategies. Because the question isn't just, why are we bad at this? It's, what do we do about it? And I want to start with the one that has the strongest empirical backing, which is gratitude practice.
Which I'll admit, when I first heard about gratitude journals, I rolled my eyes hard enough to see my own brain. It sounded like the kind of thing people put on throw pillows.
I had the same reaction. It sounds like wellness industry fluff. But the research is robust. Robert Emmons at UC Davis has been running gratitude studies for over 20 years. In the landmark study, he had people write down 5 things they were grateful for once a week. The control group wrote down 5 hassles or 5 neutral events. After 10 weeks, the gratitude group reported 25% higher life satisfaction, exercised more, had fewer physical complaints, and slept better. These are not small effects.
25% higher life satisfaction from writing down 5 things once a week. That's almost irritatingly simple.
And the mechanism is interesting. It's not that writing down gratitudes makes you realize your life is secretly great. It's that it retrains your attentional filter. Your brain is constantly scanning the environment for threats and problems. That's the negativity bias, and it's evolutionarily ancient. If you missed a threat, you died. If you missed a positive thing, you just missed it. So the default setting is to notice what's wrong. Gratitude practice forces your attention to notice what's already working, and over time that becomes more automatic.
It's not about manufacturing fake positivity. It's about correcting a baked-in asymmetry in what your brain pays attention to.
And the counterintuitive finding from Emmons' work is that it works better when you don't do it every day. Once a week produced stronger effects than daily journaling, probably because daily becomes rote. The novelty of the exercise matters. Your brain has to actually search for things to be grateful for, and that search is where the retraining happens.
That's a useful nuance. The weekly thing also makes it feel less like homework, which for someone like me is critical. If it becomes a chore, I will nap instead.
You'll nap regardless.
True, but I'll feel less guilty about it if I'm not avoiding a daily journal.
The second strategy that has strong evidence behind it is what researchers call savoring. And this is distinct from gratitude. Gratitude is retrospective, appreciating what you have. Savoring is present moment, deliberately amplifying positive experiences while they're happening.
Give me an example of what that looks like in practice.
Fred Bryant at Loyola University Chicago developed most of the savoring research. One of his interventions is absurdly simple. When something good happens, you get good news, you eat something delicious, you see a beautiful sunset, you pause for 10 to 15 seconds and actively tell yourself, "This is a good moment and I'm going to remember it." You focus on the sensory details. You share it with someone if they're there. You resist the urge to immediately move on to the next thing.
The opposite of what most of us do, which is take a photo, post it, and immediately forget the actual experience.
There's actually research specifically on that. Taking photos can either enhance or diminish savoring depending on your intent. If you're taking photos to curate an image for others, it pulls you out of the experience. If you're taking photos to capture details you want to remember, it can deepen engagement. The distinction is whether the photo is for you or for an audience.
That's the social media tax on happiness, isn't it? The moment becomes content, and content is for other people, and suddenly you're experiencing your own life as a performance.
This connects directly back to Daniel's prompt, because what he's describing is people who predicate their happiness on somebody else's standards. Social media is the single most efficient machine ever built for making you feel like your life is inadequate by someone else's metrics. You're not comparing your actual life to someone else's actual life. You're comparing your behind the scenes to everyone else's highlight reel.
The highlight reel thing gets said a lot, but it's worth saying again because it's so easy to forget in the moment. You know intellectually that the person posting the vacation photos also had a fight with their spouse at the airport. You know the person with the perfect kitchen probably financed it and is stressed about payments, but the knowing doesn't always reach the feeling.
There's a study from the University of Michigan that tracked Facebook use and well-being over time. They found that the more people used Facebook, the worse they felt moment to moment, and the more their life satisfaction declined over the 2-week study period, and the effect wasn't small. It was comparable in magnitude to the negative effects of unemployment or divorce on well-being.
A social media habit having effects comparable to unemployment on your happiness. That's a sentence that should make people put their phones down for a minute.
The mechanism they identified was specifically social comparison. Not information overload, not time displacement. It was looking at other people's curated lives and feeling inadequate. The interesting wrinkle is that passive consumption had the negative effect, but active communication, actually messaging people, having conversations, didn't. So it's not the platform itself, it's the scrolling.
Which brings us to another strategy that keeps coming up in this literature, the distinction between intrinsic and extrinsic goals. This feels central to what Daniel's asking about.
This comes out of self-determination theory, DC, and Ryan's work. They found that goals fall into two broad categories. Intrinsic goals are things like personal growth, close relationships, contribution to community, physical health. Extrinsic goals are wealth, fame, status, image. And the finding, replicated across cultures and age groups, is that pursuing intrinsic goals is associated with higher well-being, and pursuing extrinsic goals is either neutral or negatively associated with well-being.
Even when you achieve the extrinsic goals.
Especially when you achieve them. The people who actually get rich, actually get famous, actually achieve the status they were chasing, they're not happier. They often report feeling emptier because they got what they were told would fulfill them and it didn't. Tim Kasser at Knox College has done the definitive work on this. He calls it the American Dream Paradox. The more people buy into materialistic values, the lower their well-being across multiple measures.
The loop Daniel's describing, I can't be happy because I haven't achieved enough, is not only false, it's actively harmful. The pursuit of the achievement is what's making you unhappy, and even if you get it, it won't help.
That's the cruelest part of the conditional happiness trap. It's not just that you're postponing happiness, it's that the condition you've set won't deliver happiness even if you meet it. It's a check that bounces.
Okay, so let's get practical. Someone listening to this recognizes themselves in the description. They're waiting to be happy until they hit some milestone. What do they actually do on a Tuesday morning?
I'd start with what psychologists call cognitive reframing, and there's a specific exercise I think is powerful. It's called the best possible self exercise. Laura King at the University of Missouri developed it. You spend 15 minutes writing about your life in the future, assuming everything has gone as well as it possibly could. You've achieved your goals, you've become the person you want to be. And you write in detail what you're doing, how you feel, who's around you.
The point of this isn't just positive fantasizing.
No, and that's a critical distinction. Just fantasizing about a perfect future without any grounding actually makes people feel worse, because it highlights the gap between fantasy and reality. What makes King's exercise different is that it forces you to articulate what you actually value. When you write about your best possible self, the things that keep coming up, the relationships, the work, the ways you spend your time, those are your intrinsic values. And once you see them on the page, you can notice that many of them are already available to you, just in less idealized forms.
It's not about manifesting. It's about pattern recognition.
You're not trying to will things into existence. You're trying to notice that the things you actually want are often closer than you think, and the things you think you want are often someone else's script.
Someone else's script. That phrase deserves more airtime. How much of what people chase is their own desire versus something they absorb from parents, peers, culture?
There's a concept in psychology called introjection. It's when you internalize other people's values and standards without really examining them. You don't choose to value a certain career path or a certain lifestyle. You absorb it from your environment, and then you experience it as your own desire. And then you fail to achieve it and feel like a failure when really you were running someone else's race.
The someone else's race thing is where a lot of the regret comes from, I'd imagine. Where's patients once saying they wish they'd achieved more? They were saying they wished they'd lived a life that was actually theirs.
The second regret in the book is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. It's essentially the same regret from a different angle. And what's striking is how many people at the end of their lives realize they made major life decisions, career, marriage, where to live, based on what would look right to others rather than what they actually wanted.
If you're in your 30s or 40s and you're hearing this, the question becomes, how do you even figure out what you actually want versus what you've introjected?
There's no perfect method, but there are some useful probes. One that I like is the why ladder. You take a goal, say, I want to be a partner at my firm, and you ask why. Because I want the recognition. Because I want to feel like I'm good enough. Because I grew up feeling overlooked. And suddenly you realize the goal isn't really about the partnership. It's about healing an old wound, and the partnership might not actually heal it.
That's uncomfortable. Most people don't want to ladder their goals into childhood wounds.
No, and you don't have to do it for everything. But doing it for even one or two major goals can be revelatory. You start to see which goals are actually yours and which are compensatory.
Let me bring in another angle. One thing I've noticed, and I wonder if the research backs this, is that people who are good at being happy tend to have a certain relationship with negative emotions. They're not Pollyannas. They're not suppressing the bad stuff. They seem to metabolize it differently.
This is a huge point, and it gets at a common misunderstanding about happiness. The goal isn't to eliminate negative emotions. That's impossible and would actually be maladaptive. Negative emotions are information. Fear tells you there's a threat. Anger tells you a boundary has been crossed. Sadness tells you something matters and you've lost it. The problem isn't having these emotions. It's getting stuck in them or avoiding them so thoroughly that they fester.
The strategy isn't think positive. It's feel what you feel without letting it become the whole story.
And this is where mindfulness comes in. And I know mindfulness has been so thoroughly commercialized that it's hard to take seriously. There are mindfulness apps and mindfulness coloring books and mindfulness branded candles.
Of course there are.
The core practice, stripped of the branding, is useful for breaking the conditional happiness loop. Mindfulness is basically the skill of noticing your thoughts and feelings without being controlled by them. You notice the thought, I'm not successful enough to be happy, and instead of believing it and spiraling, you recognize it as a thought, a mental event, not a fact.
That tiny gap between having the thought and believing the thought, that's where the freedom is.
That's beautifully put, and there's neuroscience behind it. Judson Brewer at Brown has done fMRI studies showing that mindfulness practice actually reduces activity in the default mode network, the part of the brain associated with mind-wandering and self-referential rumination. People who practice mindfulness literally spend less time in the mental loops that generate conditional unhappiness.
You're not fighting the thoughts. You're just not letting them set up camp.
The thoughts will come. The I'm not enough thoughts. The I'll be happy when thoughts. They're deeply conditioned. But you can change your relationship to them from believer to observer.
Let me push on something. All of these strategies, gratitude, savoring, mindfulness, the best possible self-exercise, they share a common thread. They're all internal. They're all about changing your mind, not your circumstances. And I think some people hear that and feel like it's gaslighting. Like, oh, so the problem is my attitude, not the fact that my life is difficult?
That's a fair objection, and it's important to address. No amount of gratitude journaling is going to fix systemic problems, poverty, illness, trauma. The point isn't that circumstances don't matter. The point is that for the majority of people in developed countries who have their basic needs met, and that's most of the audience for this conversation, the variance in happiness is driven far more by internal factors than external ones. And the external factors people chase, more money, more status, more stuff, have rapidly diminishing returns.
The diminishing returns on money is a specific finding, right? There's been a lot of debate about the exact threshold.
The classic finding from Kahneman and Deaton was that emotional well-being rises with income up to about $75,000 a year and then plateaus. More recent work by Matthew Killingsworth at Penn, using experience sampling with tens of thousands of people, found that well-being continues to rise beyond that for most people, but the effect size shrinks dramatically. Going from $30,000 to $60,000 is enormous for well-being. Going from $300,000 to $600,000 is barely detectable.
Money matters when you don't have enough. Once you have enough, chasing more is a happiness project with terrible return on investment.
Enough is the word. Most people never define what enough is. They just keep accumulating because the default assumption is that more is better. But if you never define enough, you can never arrive.
That's the definition of the treadmill, isn't it? Enough is always one more step away.
There's a concept from behavioral economics called the arrival fallacy. It's the belief that when you arrive at a certain destination, you'll be happy. And the fallacy is that you do arrive and you're not happy, because the anticipation was the pleasure, not the achievement. The achievement is often anticlimactic, and then you need a new destination.
How do you actually get off? What's the practical move?
One approach that has some evidence behind it is what's called satisficing, a term from Herbert Simon combining satisfy and suffice. It's the opposite of maximizing. A maximizer tries to make the optimal choice in every situation. The best job, the best partner, the best restaurant. A satisficer sets criteria for what's good enough and then stops looking. And the research by Barry Schwartz and others shows that satisficers are consistently happier than maximizers, even when maximizers objectively achieve better outcomes.
Because the maximizer is always haunted by the possibility that there was a better option.
Even when they choose well, they're not satisfied because they can imagine a counterfactual that might have been better. The satisficer makes a choice that meets their standards and moves on with their life. The mental energy saved is enormous.
Satisficing is basically the antidote to FOMO. You're deliberately not optimizing.
This applies directly to happiness. The maximizer says, I can't be happy until I've maximized my life. The best job, the best body, the best home. The satisficer says, is my life good enough to be happy in? Then I'll be happy.
The phrase, good enough to be happy in, that's a reframe that probably makes a lot of maximizers uncomfortable. It feels like settling.
That's the cultural script we've all internalized, that settling is failure. That enough is mediocrity, that if you're not striving, you're stagnating. But the people on their deathbeds weren't saying, I wish I'd strived harder. They were saying, I wish I'd enjoyed what I had.
There's a paradox there. The people who are most driven to achieve are often the least able to enjoy their achievements. The drive that gets them there is the same drive that prevents them from ever arriving.
This is where self-compassion comes in, which is another evidence-based strategy. Kristen Neff at UT Austin has pioneered this research. Self-compassion isn't self-esteem. Self-esteem is contingent. I feel good about myself because I achieved something. Self-compassion is unconditional. I treat myself with kindness regardless of achievement. And her research shows that self-compassion predicts well-being more strongly than self-esteem does. And unlike self-esteem, it doesn't require constant achievement to maintain.
It's the difference between I'm worthy because I succeeded, and I'm worthy, period. And I'll be kind to myself whether I succeed or fail.
And for people stuck in the conditional happiness loop, self-compassion is the exit ramp. You stop beating yourself up for not having arrived yet. You stop making happiness contingent on being a better version of yourself. You let yourself be happy now, as you are, with all the incompleteness.
Which is literally what Ware's patients were saying. I wish I'd let myself be happier. Not, I wish I'd earned happiness. They already had permission. They just didn't give it to themselves.
That's the thing that's so striking about the regret. It's not about circumstances. It's about permission. These were people from all walks of life, all levels of achievement, all kinds of struggles. And the common thread was that they realized, too late, that the barrier to happiness had been internal all along.
Let me ask you something. You've thought about this a lot. You've read the research. You're a retired pediatrician who's seen families in some of the hardest moments of their lives. Do you actually apply any of this?
That's a fair question. I'm not great at it consistently. The gratitude practice, I do it, but I fall off and have to restart. The mindfulness, I have a meditation app that I use maybe 3 times a week when I'm being good, and then I'll go 2 weeks without opening it. But when I'm doing these things, I notice a difference. My baseline is less reactive. I'm less likely to spiral when something goes wrong.
I think the honesty about inconsistency is actually more useful than pretending you've mastered it. People hear about these strategies and think they have to do them perfectly or not at all, and then they miss a day and quit.
The research on habit formation supports exactly that. The people who succeed at building new practices aren't the ones who never miss a day. They're the ones who miss a day and then get back on track instead of deciding they've failed. The all-or-nothing mindset is itself a form of conditional happiness. I can't be a person who practices gratitude unless I do it perfectly.
The perfectionism is the thing, isn't it? It's the thread that runs through all of this. Perfectionism makes you set conditions for happiness that can never be met, and then it makes you feel like a failure for not meeting them, and then it tells you you don't deserve to be happy until you do.
Perfectionism is socially rewarded. We call it high standards, or attention to detail. We hire for it, we praise it. But clinically, perfectionism is associated with depression, anxiety, eating disorders, and suicide risk. It's not a virtue that went too far. It's a risk factor.
That's a sentence that should be on billboards. Perfectionism is a risk factor, not a humble brag.
Thomas Curran at the London School of Economics has done fascinating work on this. He's found that perfectionism has been rising steadily in young people over the past 3 decades. And he ties it directly to the rise of competitive individualism and social media. Young people today feel they have to be perfect because they're constantly being evaluated, constantly being compared, constantly curating a self for public consumption.
The conditions for conditional happiness are getting worse, generation by generation.
They're being amplified. The cultural machinery that tells you you're not enough is more powerful than it's ever been, and that makes the counter strategies more important, not less.
Let me bring this back to something concrete. If someone is listening and they recognize the conditional happiness pattern in themselves, they're waiting to be happy until the promotion, the relationship, the weight loss, whatever. What's the one thing they should do tomorrow morning?
I'd say start with the permission. Before any technique or practice, just notice the condition you've set. Notice that you've told yourself you can't be happy until X. And then ask yourself, who set that condition? Is it actually yours? And what would happen if you just for a day? What if you let yourself be happy tomorrow as an experiment without having earned it?
That's scary for a lot of people. The idea of being happy without having earned it feels almost immoral.
That's the Protestant work ethic baked into the culture so deep we don't even see it. Happiness as reward, joy as compensation for effort. But what if happiness isn't something you earn? What if it's something you practice?
That's the shift, isn't it? From happiness as destination to happiness as practice. From noun to verb.
That's where the strategies become not just techniques, but a way of being. Gratitude isn't a task. It's practicing attention. Savoring isn't an exercise. It's practicing presence. Self-compassion isn't a therapy tool. It's practicing kindness toward the person you actually are, not the person you think you should be.
The person you actually are, not the person you think you should be. There's a lot in that gap.
That gap is where most people spend their entire lives. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 19th century, a French physicist named Félix Savart built a giant toothed wheel that he spun at precise speeds to generate specific musical pitches. The device was so loud it could reportedly be heard across an entire village. Savart used it to study the lower limits of human hearing, but the villagers of the small town in Niger where he conducted his field tests in the early medieval period simply incorporated the sounds into their oral storytelling traditions, treating the tones as the voice of a spirit they called the humming ancestor.
Not right. To wrap this up, the prompt asked how to break the loop of conditional happiness, and I think what we've landed on is that the loop breaks when you stop treating happiness as something you arrive at and start treating it as something you practice. The research is remarkably consistent on this. Circumstances matter less than we think. Intentional activity matters more. And the biggest barrier isn't what's happening to you. It's the conditions you've attached to your own permission to be happy.
If I had to leave listeners with one thought, it's that the permission doesn't come from achieving enough. It comes from deciding you're enough. Which sounds like a greeting card, but it's also what the data says. The people at the end of their lives don't wish they'd been harder on themselves. They wish they'd been kinder.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtaub, for keeping this show running, and for whatever that fact was.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, where you can browse every episode and send us your own prompt. We read all of them.
Let yourself be happy. It's later than you think.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.